order and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1202 and ask Senator Q-Tub to come and introduce the bill and also Gina McLeod. Gina here.
I think she's run up here. You want me to go ahead?
Yes,
sir. Chair? Well,
you wouldn't
the other member.
Are you Gina?
No.
Oh. Okay. Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Member of the committee? For the record, my name is Eileen Tutab, and I'm a state senator for District Number 4, which is Beaverton and Tigard area. And I'm here today to introduce Senate Bill 1202. I introduced it at the request of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And what it does is appropriate 2% of the monies collected in the criminal fines and assessment account to a sexual assault victims fund for the purposes of funding sexual assault service providers, which assist victims of sexual assault. There are only 2 rape crisis centers in the state, and they are run solely by volunteer efforts, and the volunteers need some support. Just as we provide assistance to victims of domestic violence with funds from the criminal fines and assessment account, I think it is appropriate that we provide that same assistance to victims of sexual violence. And basically, that is just a quick rundown of why I introduced the bill, and I would appreciate your consideration.
Have you studied the amendment?
I haven't.
Okay, there's a dash one.
I know there is a dash one, and probably the coalition could tell you a little bit more about what they amended and why.
Okay, we only have 3 people here scheduled other than yourself to testify, and I had indicated that I was just going to introduce it this morning, but I think we can go ahead since there's only 2 more that wanted to do that. If Gina's not here, there's Phyllis Barkhurst. Phyllis Barkhurst here? Come forward.
Mr. Chair, would you excuse me?
Certainly. Thank you.
Have another appointment, so I'd really appreciate your consideration.
Yeah, if you could have your staff maybe look at the dash one amendments and let me know.
All right, I think they probably have. And I will let you know.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you taking your time to come. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Senator Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Phyllis Barkhurst, and I've been providing services to Oregon sexual assault victims for the past 15 years in this state. I spent 7 years in Klamath Falls and have been in my current role as Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services in Eugene for more than 7 years now. For the past 11 years, I've traveled the state providing training and technical assistance to nonprofits, hospital units, and law enforcement on the issue of responding to the needs of victims of sexual assault. I've trained folks from Astoria to Pendleton, Ontario to Coos Bay, Lakeview to the Dalles, and most places in between. 1 out of every 4 women is raped as an adult in this country. 1 out of 3 teenage girls experience some type of unwanted sexual contact. The FBI estimates that 1 in 35 rapes are reported to law enforcement, but rape crisis centers like ours report the numbers to be closer to 1 in 100. Whichever number you use, it is agreed that very few sexual assaults are reported. But reported or not, victims of rape and other sexual assaults are victims of crime and need services. Receiving crisis intervention, advocacy, and other types of support services can mitigate the trauma to a victim and her family. The crime of rape occurs in every city and every town in the state. Survivors of these crimes live in every community in Oregon. If you're a victim of sexual assault and you live in Eugene or Springfield, you'll have the option of an array of services from 24-hour crisis lines to support groups. This is the only location in the state where an entire continuum of services is offered to victims of sexual assault. As a victim of sexual assault in the Portland metro area, you'll find a crisis line and some very limited advocacy. In Corvallis, Gold Beach, Burns, Ontario, the Dalles, Baker City, almost nothing. In Klamath Falls, you have access to a medical advocate who will go with you to the hospital. That's it. In St. Helens, Coos Bay, Grants Pass, Pendleton, and Lakeview, you can call a crisis line. From the coast to Snake River, from California to the Columbia, you will find almost every county has little to nothing to offer survivors of sexual assault. In Oregon, we are miles away from being adequate in our response to the needs of victims traumatized by these crimes. Why is this? One answer. In Oregon, we provide services to victims of sexual assault in the shadow of domestic violence programs. In our state, this is where the funds are. This is where local and statewide resources go. In fact, there are many people at all levels of government, the public, and social services who don't understand the issue of sexual assault that is a separate issue, distinct from and very distinct from the issue of domestic violence. And there are more people who are victimized by sexual assault than by domestic violence. The dual impact in Oregon of the funding sources being limited to domestic violence services, along with the rise of public awareness in response to the issue of domestic violence, has led to a remarkable change in the way this state addresses this issue. In my 15 years in Oregon, I've seen a change so remarkable that it impacts the issue of domestic violence at every level, from police intervention to services, from public policy to funding. In that same time, the issue of sexual assault has not changed at all. The two biggest factors in changing the entire statewide response to domestic violence are missing in the response to the issue of sexual assault. There's little public awareness or buy-in that this is an issue needing support and attention, and there are no state resources, no local resources, and few ongoing federal or private resources going to this issue in this state. In Oregon, there is a multidisciplinary movement afoot to begin to address the issue of public awareness and public investment in this issue. We are holding the Oregon Sexual Assault Summit in Bend in May 6th and 7th to really kick off this process of seeing the state of this issue. 150 participants from every county are coming, include victim advocates, law enforcement, district attorneys, and health professionals. The goal of the summit is to both identify where we are as a state in responding to these issues and to develop a plan to better address them in the future. One issue that is already clear statewide is the need for comprehensive and consistent services to victims. To make that happen, there needs to be funding. A specific funding source that is designated for victim services will mandate that services be delivered while demonstrating that the state recognizes the need and is doing something to address it. 100% of statewide funding in Oregon designated to the issue of sexual assault goes to prosecution, incarceration, probation, parole, and treatment of offenders. Zero goes to victim services for rape or sexual assault survivors. There are limited federal dollars going to support victim services in Oregon. With two exceptions, the funds go to domestic violence programs and are not enough to turn them into truly dual-purpose agencies. Many of us on the front lines have been on the lookout for a funding source for nonprofit victim services to sexual assault survivors for years. When it came to my attention that there are restitution funds being collected from convicted criminals that go directly into Oregon's general fund, I believe they found a source that makes sense. It makes sense that funds that are collected from criminals go to support victims of sexual assault. While Oregon always has a need for funds and the general revenue budget is never nearly enough, I believe that the state has a lesser claim on fines criminals pay than do survivors of sexual assault. The minuscule number of victims of sexual offenders ever see justice done in this state. Making a decision to use criminal fines to support and mitigate the trauma these victims suffer is just. Please make it so. Thank you.
They asked about the amendment.
Okay. Senators, my name is Gina McLeod. I'm the staff attorney with the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I just had a few brief comments, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions specific to the amendments or otherwise. I wanted to point out that there are many other states that do provide a great deal of funding for sexual assault services. And I'm just going to highlight my own personal experience because it is so recent. Before I was here at the Oregon Coalition, I was the staff attorney at the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I believe, as Phyllis pointed out, there are only two standalone rape crisis centers in the state of Oregon. But because we have for so long been working with the Illinois legislature, there are 48 standalone rape crisis centers in Illinois. And that is not an anomaly to Illinois. There are many other states that have found that sexual assault is distinct in its services to rape victims in comparison to domestic violence or mental health services, and they have put monies towards supporting these services. And I want to give some examples of why this is so important. And I just have one that always stands out when people ask me, well, what are some of the services that would go distinctly for rape victims versus victims of domestic violence? And I have heard this particular scenario over and over, but it stands out and it is just a perfect example about why these monies are so important. When rape victims present at the emergency room, the law enforcement officers who come to do the investigation will take the rape victim's clothing. If a rape advocate is even in the area, if a program is lucky enough to actually have the money to have rape victim advocates that can come, oftentimes they will come to the hospital. They will stay with the victim while she has the rape kit done on her, and she will also support the victim and the victim's family, if they're present, to answer any questions and to provide referrals to other services. However, there was a case, and I'm sure that this is not just one, where the rape victim went to the hospital to have an exam. She was interviewed by the law enforcement officers. There was no one for the rape victim to call. She gave her clothes to the law enforcement officer, and she had nothing to leave the hospital in but a hospital gown. Because she was, for a variety of reasons, not able to return to her home, because that's where the assault took place, she was escorted by law enforcement in her hospital gown to the motel, and then the next day from the motel to a crisis center that could help her about 2 hours away, still in her hospital gown. Now, this is a stark example of one of the areas in which this pool of money would be able to help rape victims in Oregon, because what we know throughout the country is that monies that are dedicated to sexual assault go to providing warm-up sweatsuits so that rape victim advocates can provide these to rape victims when they have their clothing taken by law enforcement. This is a very small example of one of the many ways that this money is vital to not only protecting the mental health of rape victims, but also to send a message to the community that rape victims are a concern of the community and that the community does, in fact, support them. That's just a short example that I wanted to highlight, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have had about the amendments here.
Are there any private industries involved in these things?
In terms of funding?
Pardon?
In terms of funding?
No, in terms of availability to respond in the type of situation.
Just the two private nonprofits that Gina mentioned.
Well, I say that there's no profit, for-profit
right.
organization that right. work in this area. You've looked at the Dashwan amendments, or are they your Dashwan?
They are. Okay. Chair Fisher, they are the coalition Chair One Dashwan amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, could you tell us what the major differences are then to the bill now that we have the Dashwan amendments in front of us?
Chair Fisher, Senator Castillo, the major differences is that that the bill now is directed specifically to nonprofit agencies, nonprofit organizations, as opposed to public agencies, because nonprofit agencies are doing this work.
It also reverses the wording instead of nonprofit private, it puts private nonprofit.
That's right. Okay. Beyond that, it's really a matter of semantics. There's nothing substantive except for the fact that it is dedicated just to a nonprofit organization.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Diane Riddle.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. My name is Diane Biddle. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. That is the facility that trains all law enforcement, correction officers, parole and probation, 911 telecommunicators, all your public safety providers, including fire. The reason I'm here today is because the law enforcement, corrections, parole and probation part of that agency is totally and completely funded by the unitary assessment, and that's what my concern is about this bill. Currently, we are unable to provide the mandated services and training that are required for law enforcement in particular. Last session, that was increased from 8 weeks to 16 weeks. We, at this point in time, only have funding for the 10 weeks. This is one of several bills that are seeking funding from the unitary assessment, which I indicated is the only source of funding for the training academy. Currently, we have a revised curriculum for teaching this very area of sexual abuse and assault of both children, adults, elders, and also domestic violence. We are only able to implement a portion of that, and while we're training more than we ever have, it still is not where we should be. And it concerns me to be taking away from one entity and giving to another versus finding another source of income. I will tell you that this is difficult for me to testify. I was one of the founders of the Women's Crisis Center in St. Helens, Oregon back in the 70s, and I also spent most of my career as a prosecutor of sexual assault and child abuse and homicides. So I have mixed emotions about this, but I do need to tell you, as the current director of the training facility, that I am opposed to taking away funding from training when we don't have adequate funding at this point in time, and that is my only concern on this measure.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
How much will this take away? And we pay 2% of what dollars?
I don't have any idea.
If it's 2%, what's 2% represent to you?
Chair Fisher, Senator Shields, I don't have an exact figure on that, but I would have to say it's probably in the area of 100,000, 200,000 potentially. It's a significant amount. And I believe this is 2% from the whole fund, so it wouldn't be all just from us. It would be across the board for everybody, so I would have to have someone do some actual calculations. I'm assuming the whole 2% is not coming from the department section.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On Section 1, 9D, is that the cost of 48 to 46% going to the general fund? Is that
line which?
Line 15. That'd be the 2% right there, looks to me.
If I may.
Well, I was just looking at on line page 1, line 15. I noticed that the formula drops from 48.6727 to 46. So that must be the transferred to the general fund used for general government expenses. Chair, then is that where your funding comes from the general fund expenditures there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, ours does not come from the general fund. It comes from a separate portion. As I read this particular bill, I think it's subsection N, while it looks like financially it takes it out of the general fund the first time, the section below that indicates that it comes from the entire fund from that point after.
Where is that? What line?
I think it's the only other bolded section in there.
That screen there. I'm seeing in there.
No, I had a
line.
Yes, Senator.
Did you say how much the difference 2% might be?
sure as much as 100,000.
Well, the question I asked is, the other day we allocated $49 million to connect our children and families, and it didn't even exist a few years ago. I'm wondering if they could contribute.
Yes, Mr. Senators, if I could just interject here, Senator Shannon, the 2% monies that this fund would attempt to go after reaches about $600,000, and the scheme of this bill is that it would reduce only the portion of the fund that goes to general fund. It does not take any percentages away from groups that are already receiving monies under the unitary assessment. So it reduces the general fund out of this unitary assessment, this criminal fines and assessment, currently around 51% goes to the general fund. This would reduce the state portion that goes back to the general fund, and nothing would not reduce any monies from groups that are currently receiving funding.
Mm-hmm. Where did you refer to when you said page, future funding?
Okay, page 2, line 8, under N, in there, it does not restrict that 2% to come from the general fund. It has it coming just generally like all the remainder of these sources. So if you look at A through N, it would not indicate that it's any different than the others, that it comes just from the unitary assessment fund. I realize that in doing the accounting on this one, under D, they had taken it out of there, but there's nothing that indicates that that's where it would continue to come from. It would seem to come from 2%, just like everyone else.
Well, naturally, if you take 2% away from the total, we'll give it to somebody else. They've got 2% in perpetuity, but it doesn't cut out from the DPSC. It doesn't, or DPSC. It just establishes that the take for the general fund will only be 46.6727 from now on anyway. And 2% of that goes over to the other, and that means that it'll be that 2% for, it's not going to be taken anywhere else, it'll just be taken out the same way from the rest of the time until it's changed.
I guess the problem that I see, Chair Fisher, is that it's another 2% coming from the entire pool.
Yes, and it was given from the entire pool by the general fund.
But these percentages change constantly, is what I'm saying. Each time there's another one of these that comes through, it comes through and affects the entire pool. So in other words,
it doesn't affect the entire pool. It only affects whichever one is reduced. You're still getting your 15.67%, and that doesn't change. That's the entire amount.
Okay, let me see if I can explain this. If there's $2 million to be dispersed and everyone does it in this percentage, and next year there's $1.5 million, then we've all lost again by as much. And by the fact that there's another person sharing, we have that percentage becomes, dollar amount becomes greater to us.
No, it doesn't either. Yours becomes greater too, just the same as theirs does. And you haven't lost the thing. You can't get more than 100% of 100%. You're still giving your 15%, so you get it out of everything coming in the future, then you get it out of today.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think what, if I'm hearing you right, as you said, this year we had $2 million coming in from this criminal fund, and next year people behave themselves better, and we only have $1.5 million. You're saying everyone is going to be, you're going to get 15% of a lesser amount.
Exactly. And so the dollar amount goes down.
You'd only get 15% of the amount anyway, because that's all you're allocated. It's not going to cut you out of a penny.
It doesn't make any difference.
They'll go down. Theirs will go down too. So will the state general fund. So will everybody else.
Yeah.
Doesn't change your percentage at all, unless somebody in law changes your percentage and takes 2% out of you, then it would affect you. But otherwise than that, you're going to rise and fall depending on the economy or depending on the diligence of the ticket writers.
Yeah.
I guess I can see your point. It's just the experience that we've had is that each time a new person comes in, we have a tendency to be adjusted and lose. I'm just presenting that.
Well, I'd go back to see that because unless somebody else is added in, unless you started taking it again over 100%, or unless your percentage started to go down, the only reason you're losing is because of either the productivity or the traffic fines, or how many of them are actually okayed by the judge, or whatever the case might be. And otherwise, Matt, you're not affected by anybody coming in unless you lose your percentage. You'd have 50,000 people come into this, and if it didn't affect your 15%, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. But you'd get, you'd still get 15% of the total amount. But it was less or more. If it's less, then you get less. If it's more, you get more. Unless your percentage changes.
And I guess that our percentage has changed over time is what part of
the concern. I can't tell you that, but this doesn't change your percentage.
Okay.
I guess everybody has to fight for their percentage down the line, but this certainly doesn't provide the future for years to be reduced, as I can see.
This is general,
yeah,
general health, I think, at this point.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1202. Thank you for coming, and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 588. Senator Brown?
I'm going to invite Kathy Eaton with the League of Women Voters and Maura Rocha-Pantone to come up with me, if that's all right. Apparently, Senator Bryan is not able to join us this morning.
I invite you to move right along because I intend to work this bill this morning and send it on its way. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. Thank you very much for your courtesies and willing to give this bill a hearing, and I appreciate the committee members' time and patience in listening. And I'd also like to give other thank yous to Senate Majority Leader Gene Durfler for his assistance. And there's several folks in the room from the insurance industry that assisted, including but not limited to John Powell, Deborah Seifert, Jay Siskam, Bruce Bishop, Peggy Annette. Colleagues, this bill simply continues coverage for mammograms and gynecological exams, which we established in 1993. In addition, in 1993, when the mandate was passed, which required coverage for mammograms annually for women over the age of 50, at that time, American Cancer Society set the standard that the annual mammograms would be for women over the age of 50. Since then, the American Cancer Society has changed the standard and lowered it and recommends it for women over the age of 40. So the bill requires coverage then for annual mammograms for women over the age of 40. In addition, it requires coverage when a woman is high risk or symptomatic and at her doctor's recommendation. Those are the amendments, the -2 amendments. The -2 amendments also delete the repeal of the sunset. So in 6 years, should we do nothing in adding the amendments, the mandate will automatically expire in 6 years. That's a compromise position. I know a lot of folks out there would like it to continue, but there are a lot of folks out there that don't. So that's certainly a compromised position. And I thankfully will not be here in 6 years to address this issue again. So we're going to let it to deal. Other folks more competent than I to deal with it in whatever year that would be. Just a couple other comments. In 1993... Right. In 1993, I believe the cost per person per month for a mammogram was 44 cents. The cost has risen somewhat to 62 cents per person per month. We frankly think Oregon women are worth 62 cents per month. And if you have any question in your mind about the need for mammograms in your packets, which were prepared by my assistant, Gina Isom, there's a chart showing the size of lumps that are found by women untrained in breast self-exam, those practicing occasional breast self-exam, those who have regular self-exams, and those who have their first mammogram and then regular mammograms. And you'll find that lumps discovered by regular mammograms are substantially smaller than those and those who practice self-exam. So Thank you again very much. Appreciate your time and attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Whatever order you wish to.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the government chair of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that encourages public participation in government. I only have 2 points that I'd like to bring to your attention. Provision of health care for women could be fundamental to the basic health of Oregon, as well as the rest of the world. Statistics show that early cancer detection clearly saves lives. This data is true for both men and women. Senate Bill 588, which would renew the current law, can provide the coverage to allow for routine exams, which could lead to early discovery and prevent both life-ending illness and costly treatment of more serious complications. We believe that the stability of families, the economic benefits for both female employees and their employers, the importance of healthy women in our society, all underline the need to provide health care access through the insurance coverage as stated in SB 88, and the League of Women Voters encourages you to move this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I want to just comment. I think this should be noted. Kathy's here today, and I just think of the great work that she's done through the years, working with education and everything else across the board, and I'm just really pleased with the work that she's done for many years, Mr.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood provides reproductive health care to more than 30,000 women and men through 9 clinics statewide, and I'm here to testify in support of SB 588 that would continue current coverage of health insurance for women's health examinations. In the 1993 legislative session, legislators felt a pressing urgency to validate the need for health insurance coverage of health exams for women, including mammograms, pelvic examinations, and screenings to detect cancer and other ailments. Those legislators, led by Representative John Schoon, realized that for many women, increased access to early detection through comprehensive insurance coverage was the only feasible way to afford regular gynecological and mammogram examinations and evaluations. Not only is this legislation crucial to the early detection of cancer, but lack of access to annual gynecological examinations can be detrimental to the discovery of other illnesses. Research has shown that reproductive health examinations and gynecological examinations are the portal of entry for women to get referrals for other health ailments. So it's critical that they have access to these services because they're sort of the routine and regular services that women obtain in terms of health care. SB 588 guarantees women's access to the most basic of women's health care. Therefore, I urge you to support 588. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And perhaps both you and Kathy will be here in 6 years.
Yeah. Representative Brown mentioned that this morning through the past news.
Since we're not term limited out, you're right.
And we hope nothing turns to be sure.
I have some questions.
Senator Chan.
I have some questions from Maura Roach. I am wondering, because your main focus, your main business, aborting babies, do you educate the women that come into your, and the men, for whatever reason you say you service men, do you tell them the facts about the more abortions, the higher your risk for breast cancer because of what developing baby does to a woman, and then for an abortion, did you tell them what the science is showing on breast cancer?
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, Planned Parenthood provides education, information, and referral regarding reproductive health care, including breast self-examination education. We also distribute the placards for women to keep in their showers to try and remind them to do self-examinations, and all of the pertinent research and data
that's available on breast cancer prevention.
So you do not tell them the effects of abortion, repeated abortions on breast cancer, the high rate of risk?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, there is at this point no research linking breast cancer to abortion services. What we do know is that...
Well, I didn't say abortion services. I said abortion to the woman's body, what it does to the woman's body. You have seen research?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, I have reviewed a great deal of research regarding this issue, and what we do know is that women who have children before the age of 30 have a decreased risk in breast cancer.
I'll get you the other research that you seem blind about. My other question is, can you explain to the women the high risk of cervical cancer the more partners she has?
Mr. Chair,
I'm starting to put that in high school. Can you disperse that information also?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, Planned Parenthood makes available to all of our patients all of the information about reproductive health care, the current research that's available about increased risk for cervical cancer, along with other sexually transmitted diseases associated with multiple partners.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody that does more abortions than Planned Parenthood?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, Planned Parenthood provides, in terms of our overall service packages in the state of Oregon, it's less than 2% of what we do in terms of providing reproductive health care to women.
One last question. What is the maximum age of the unborn baby that you do an abortion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, Planned Parenthood does first trimester abortions only in the state of Oregon.
Yeah. I know a woman that had a 5-month on there. I know her very well. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for your testimony this morning. I'm so happy to see this bill before us. This is definitely a service that we need to have continued. And having the mandate in place helps assure that that will continue to happen. And I also just wanted to, commend Planned Parenthood for the great programs and services that Planned Parenthood provides to this state. They play a very, very important role in delivering health care services to women and families in this state. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you very much for being here.
Lenore Paulson and Margaret Wonky Shields and Wendy Rankin.
Chairman Fisher and Senators, I'm Lenore Paulson from Roseburg, and I left Roseburg at 5:30 this morning to be at this hearing because I believe Senate Bill 588 is a critical part of the race for the cure of breast cancer. This disease has wreaked havoc with my whole life. My mother was 33 when she died of breast cancer, and I was 2.5. I had breast cancer 10 years ago, but a routine mammogram saved my life. Mammograms were not available for my mother, but young women, young mothers, and other women now have the opportunity to treat this disease at an early stage when a cure is possible and even likely. Mammograms are so effective in the discovery of breast cancer, but younger women and women with young families are at a greater risk when insurance does not cover the cost, and there are many other demands on family income. This is a serious bill that, if passed with your support, will help save lives, save health insurance dollars in the long run, and may help prevent the kind of tragedy that has happened in my family. I believe all of us, including health insurance companies and legislators, should support this bill, which encourages the practice of a proven preventive measure that will save lives and lower the cost of health care. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak on this proposed legislation, and I will be back in 6 years.
We're taking on the quality of General MacArthur.
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Warnsey Shields. I'm a breast cancer survivor. 9 years ago, almost to the day, I had my annual gynecological exam. My physician noted that I had just turned 40 and that it was time to have another mammogram. At age 36, on his recommendation, I had a baseline mammogram. I knew my insurance didn't cover mammograms. Since it was just after April 15th and our checking account had taken a hit, I was rather reluctant to spend the money for a mammogram and had really thought it was pointless. After all, wouldn't the insurance company cover the cost of a mammogram if it were so important? For this reason, making a mammogram appointment was not high on my priority list. But I knew, too, that if I didn't get the mammogram, my physician would once again remind me of its importance. So after a delay of several weeks, I made the appointment, I had the mammogram, I wrote the check for the mammogram, and thought that was that. Wrong. Less than a week after the mammogram, my physician called me and told me I needed to consult a surgeon. Within 5 weeks of having had that mammogram, I was told that I had breast cancer. I then had surgery and began a long 6 months of chemotherapy. If I hadn't found a way to pay for that mammogram, I question if I might be here speaking to you today. I consider myself very fortunate to have been able to follow the advice of my physician and not to have had to make a choice between buying groceries for a week and a mammogram. Other women have not been so fortunate. In their memory, please pass this bill. Thank you from all Oregon women.
Jeremy, yes, what is the what's the general cost of a mammogram?
Well, in 19...
Well, right, I realize it's probably... What was it then?
Chair Fisher and Senator Duncan in 1990, it was $80.
$80, so it must be $125? Yeah, that's significant.
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Wendy Rankin, and I am also a survivor. For the past 20 years, I've worked as a public health professional and have been well apprised of the impact of mammography in assuring early and therefore treatable detection of breast cancer. But today, however, I am here as a citizen who has experienced firsthand the benefits of this important procedure. 4 years ago this month, I presented myself to my health practitioner with pain in my right breast. She ordered a stat mammogram, and the following day I was scheduled for a surgical consultation. The radiologist who read my mammogram was so convinced that I had a tumor that the usual biopsy was not even considered, and surgery proceeded with a lumpectomy and axillary node dissection within weeks. As it turned out, the cancer had metastasized to my lymph nodes, and I was faced with a difficult year of treatment, including surgery, radiation, and months of chemotherapy and physical rehabilitation. In my case, that mammogram was a clear, effective, and definitive diagnostic tool. Without it, I am sure my treatment plan would have been delayed. With a fast-growing cancer as I had, I can only imagine what that delay might have meant for me. Happily, I have recovered from my treatment. But as you are aware, breast cancer is a chronic disease, one for which there is no cure. Every year, when I return to my annual mammogram, I undergo the anxiety and relief that every breast cancer survivor knows so well. Today, after regaining my full range of motion, I'm a member of the Susan G. Komen-sponsored Dragon Boat team known as Pink Phoenix. The phoenix in our name refers to the mythical Egyptian phoenix that rose from the ashes with pride and hope. The women of Pink Phoenix come from all backgrounds and walks of life, but have two common bonds. These are a love of athleticism and the survival of breast cancer. I spoke with my teammates at a practice on Wednesday night and shared my intention of speaking to you today.
My teammates are horrified at the thought that mammograms might not be available to some Oregonian women. Every one of them urged me to encourage you to approve this bill. Mammograms are a crucial tool in the provision of healthy lives for citizens of this state. As a breast cancer survivor, I implore you to pass Senate Bill 588 so that every woman in Oregon has a better chance to rise from the ashes of breast cancer. Thank you.
I don't want to let it go on record. This is not going to offer mammograms to every woman in Oregon, not even remotely. This is merely affecting, basically, as I understand it, private insurance companies that offer policies that are bought by private companies. Mm. This doesn't mandate anything about union insurance. It doesn't mandate anything about union trusts or self-insured. I don't even think it affects the Oregon Health Plan. And certainly doesn't affect those that do not have any insurance at all. And so this really, in reality, is a help, but it's certainly not a cure for the entire problem. So I want that on the record. Senator Brown,
yeah, I just wanted to respond. This obviously does cover private insurance, but does not cover self-insured, which my understanding is about 15%, 15 to 20% of the insurance population. However, the Oregon Health Plan does cover mammograms. I don't know what number it is on the list. It's very high on the list of the Oregon Health Plan.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, yeah, a group plans, for example, the state programs, are they covered?
No.
They are covered now.
Currently,
Most group plans. I'm looking at our insurance people back
here.
Yeah,
I see. Mr. Fiskin, now you said.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's self-insured that they would not be required to be covered, and that's about 15 to 20% of the insurance.
Does that cover the union trust?
I don't believe so. That's federal. I assume that's the ERISA.
Yeah, and that would be a certain percentage, too.
Right.
And this would also not cover anyone that was not picked up by their insured. So if an insured doesn't have insurance for their dependents, that would not help with that either.
Chairman Fisher, it just shows we have a long way yet.
We need you back in this room.
Well, this has been one of the concerns that I've had with the run on insurance. There's so many dollars, it doesn't really make any difference whether it's coming out of the private pocket or out of the government's pocket. There's only so much money for insurance, and Oregon has been trending much different than the rest of the United States. And the only thing that I could figure is when everybody tells me that all the rest of the United States has all these mandates and there's little employers are not buying insurance to any great extent, that tells me one thing, they priced it out of the market. And that's a very great concern to me. And I have not wanted to yo-yo back and forth and take it from one group one session and give it to another group and then turn around and take it from that group and give it back to someone else as the pressures of public opinion vacillate from session to session and from election to election and that type of thing. And it's a very frustrating thing for me. I think most of you remember that I was here in 93 and I supported this in 93. And it's not that we don't support these things. It's a matter of how do we pay for them, both in the government and in the private industry. And I very much want to encourage private industry to continue in purchasing insurance for their employees and make it available to them. And so I'm particularly pleased that the group have gotten together and have reached an agreement so that we can be here today, because that indicates to me that at least we're working in something that is at least affordable and people feel that they can reach and that will do some good work and help the process along, because we won't solve all the ills simultaneously with a snap of the finger. These are educational processes, funding processes, there's all kinds of things that go into the working on these arrangements, and just to force something because the people would support it doesn't really help the matter. In fact, it could seriously injure the work that we're doing right now. So again, I would like to say how much I appreciate the different groups being willing to get together and do a little give and take here and provide us with something that we can look forward to being very helpful to many people and recognize even then, as you say, we've got a lot of work left ahead of us. So I want to say thank you right now before I forget to those ladies that have come forth today to talk about something that's been very, very close to them and something that they have suffered dearly going through the process of, and to all other families that have been in these types of situations. My heart goes out to you, and my thanks for you being willing to come here and further the cause of being willing to put yourself on the stand and in the public and support these issues, because they're very, very definitely worthy goals. Further questions from, and I know some of you travel over 100 miles. Thank you, Donna. Michelle Sands, Renata Stiles, Jane Moore. I have also a couple of letters, I think, that I'm going to include. I don't see the people's names here testifying, so we'll wait and see if they come up and testify. We won't have to introduce them, but if they don't, I'll introduce their letters for the record. Go ahead. I don't care which order. I just call them off and I'm here.
Good morning, Chairman Fisher and members of the committee. I'm here today to to ask you to support the passage of Senate Bill 588.
Would you introduce yourself?
My name is Michelle Sines, and I reside at 4729 Southeast 43rd Street in Portland, Oregon. There are two main reasons why I personally wanted to come before you today to urge that you pass this bill. The first reason is that I'm the American Cancer Society Breast Cancer Programs Manager for the state of Oregon. In my position, I'm responsible for the programs that support women with breast cancer and educate and inform women about breast cancer, its detection, and subsequent survival from it if it's detected early enough. The second reason is more personal one. I am a breast cancer survivor also. One of the many services that the American Cancer Society performs, besides support and education, is the provision of guidelines about screening measures for different types of cancer. The media and the public rely on the American Cancer Society for such guidelines. The statistics that come from the millions of dollars the American Cancer Society spends on researching cancer support the importance of mammograms and gynecological exams. Senate Bill 588 addresses both of these screening measures and is congruent with the wisdom of the research that we have. Without the passage of this bill, many women would not be able to have their women's health exams covered by the insurance that they pay for in good faith. Regular mammogram screening has been shown to reduce breast cancer mortality significantly, which is why the American Cancer Society recommends that women age 40 and older obtain annual mammograms. Mammograms can be life-saving and breast-saving. In other words, the earlier the diagnosis, the greater the chance of survival, less drastic measures are needed for treatment, and more treatment options are available. The other women's health exam this bill covers is gynecological exams. This is another killer that, when detected early through screening, is one of the most successfully treatable cancers, and in some cases, if detected in a precancerous state, can be prevented. The American Cancer Society recommends that women 18 years and older receive annual pelvic exams with Pap screening for cervical cancer. Facts and statistics usually point to people, not to Senate bills. Fortunately, in the case of screening measures for cancer, they pointed to me and helped me to survive this disease. For many women, access to detect their cancer early and to have the choice to do so depends on you passing this bill. Thanks in great part to the measures like the ones in this bill. Tomorrow, I will celebrate my 4-year anniversary of being free from breast cancer. I want to encourage you to pass Senate Bill 588 so that women in the state of Oregon will continue to be able to say, as I am now, that they have survived cancer. On behalf of the American Cancer Society, we ask that you don't hesitate in passing a bill that will affect the health and the lives of the women in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Fisher, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Renata Stiles, and I reside in New York, Oregon. I'm here today to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 588. I am representing the American Cancer Society, where I'm employed as the Director of Early Detection and Patient Services for the metro area. Additionally, as a volunteer, I am the President of the Board of Directors and Acting CEO of the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation, Oregon affiliate. First, I shall address my experience directly in working to fight breast cancer at the American Cancer Society. My days are often filled with the voices and the faces of women, men, and children battling cancer. In the past 3 years, I've spoken directly with hundreds of women attempting to cope with a breast cancer diagnosis. Their stories stay with me. Today, I'm thinking about Carol. I helped Carol write milestone letters to her husband and two daughters she would soon be leaving behind as she knew she was dying of breast cancer. The letters were to be delivered as tender messages for all of the future important events that she would miss in their lives. Graduations, weddings, births, wedding anniversaries, and the like. Carol did not have her breast cancer detected early. A mammogram may have allowed Carol what all mothers want, to be there for their family. Carol was diagnosed before there was a mandate to cover mammograms. Because we can't yet prevent breast cancer, we must place a tremendous importance in educating women about the need for early detection. Presently, there are two major barriers to getting home that message to women: fear and ambivalence. Failing to pass SB 588 will add a third barrier to the already daunting list: economics. A woman may argue with herself that if it really were that important to get a yearly mammogram, her insurance surely would cover it. And when faced with a choice between paying for a mammogram or buying her son his school shoes, I fear that many women will put other needs or the needs of others before their own. When that woman is working for or directly paying for health insurance, it is not a choice that she should have to make. The Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation in Oregon is dedicated to working in partnership with the Oregon Health Division and the CDC to provide a safety net for underserved women who afford mammograms. You may not recognize the name Komen, but most certainly you have heard of the Komen Race for the Cure, a fundraising event which happens in communities all throughout the country. The Portland Race is the largest all-woman race in the country. Last year, we had over 33,000 participants. A conservative estimate for this September's race will be 40,000 strong. This incredible growth demonstrates an ever-increasing concern and passion that Oregonians feel for the fight against breast cancer. Oregonians care about this topic. In the past several months, I've received many calls from Komen supporters worried over the fate of Senate Bill 588. Some are from families like Carol's, who don't want to see Oregon take a giant step backwards in becoming one of only three states in the country without the certainty of mammogram coverage. Others feel they could not afford to pay for mammograms directly, especially when they have insurance, which is they feel should be concerned as much with detecting breast cancer early as it is with profit margins. I don't believe that anyone in this room doesn't care about saving lives from breast cancer. As sure as if they were right here in this room, the thousands of women who are pictured in the photo of Race Day before you are all standing behind me, all of them looking to this committee today to move forward Senate Bill 588. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Perhaps we have a couple of the other bills to do besides this, and if you could maybe condense just a little bit here. We still have about three folks to go that have signed up, and we do wish to get a work session and go ahead on this bill. So.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief this morning. Members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Jane Moore, and I manage health promotion and chronic disease prevention programs for the Oregon Health Division. One of the programs that is included in the area that I manage is a program funded by the Centers for Disease Control to promote education and outreach for early detection of breast and cervical cancer. This is a topic very near and dear to me because I was able to start that program for Oregon. You've heard from several women this morning. What I'm going to talk about very briefly are some data, but behind each of these numbers are women like you've been hearing from today, so I don't want us to get lost in the numbers and not remember that they represent individual women. The Health Division is supporting Senate Bill 588 for three reasons. First, breast cancer is the most common cancer in Oregon women. 2,615 Oregon women were diagnosed with breast cancer in 1996. That's the latest year for which we have data. And 517 women died from breast cancer that year. Second, early diagnosis through screening absolutely saves lives, and it is our primary defense against breast and cervical cancer. And third, Oregon women with insurance coverage are more likely to get these life-saving screenings. So let me give you just a few numbers on these last 2 points. The five-year survival rate for women whose breast cancers are diagnosed at a localized stage, that means that the cancer is still within the breast tissue, is 97%. Survival rates for women whose cancers are detected at later stages, if the cancer has spread to other parts of the body, is between 22 and 77%. In 1996 in Oregon, almost 30% of breast cancers were diagnosed at these later stages. This is something that we can change by assuring that women have regular screening for early detection. In 1996, 121 Oregon women were diagnosed with invasive cervical cancer, and 47 women died from cervical cancer. In Oregon, this is a tragedy. No woman should die from cervical cancer. There is no need for a woman to ever develop invasive cervical cancer. Pap tests can detect precancerous cells before they ever invade the cervix. We have some work to do in Oregon. What about getting regular screening? In 1997, 78% of Oregon women over the age of 50 had mammograms. This is an 11% increase since 1993 when this insurance coverage was passed. What this translates into is more than 114,000 more women have gotten mammograms since 1993 than they would have if we stayed at the same screening level. Does insurance make a difference in screening rates? Absolutely. The results are rather startling. In 1997, 80% of women over the age of 50 who had insurance had gotten a mammogram. In contrast, 35% of women over the age of 50 who did not have insurance received a mammogram. That's a very wide difference. Breast cancer costs a lot of money, billions of dollars. It costs more than any other cancer. Early detection and treatment cost considerably less for both breast and cervical cancer, and that's just in dollars. The same is true for suffering as well. Relative to other medical expenditures, cancer screening in women is highly cost-effective. For a very small investment, we're saving lives and buying an enormous amount of increased quality of life in Oregon women. As you've heard before, our only defense against these cancers are early detection through screening. Data show that lack of insurance coverage is a major barrier. This insurance is already in place in Oregon. It will not cost more to continue it. For all of these reasons, I urge you to support Senate Bill 588. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Judy Johnson, Joseph Smith, and Bruce Bishop. Go right ahead, Jean.
Chairman Fisher and committee members, for the record, my name is Judy Johnson. I'm from Scappoose, Oregon. I'm here today to urge you to support Senate Bill 588 so that women's gynecological exams and mammograms will continue to be covered by all insurance companies. 2.5 years ago, I had a mammogram which showed a lump in my left breast so small that neither I nor three individual doctors could feel it, even when we knew right where it was. I had a lumpectomy, lymph node dissection, and radiation with minimum recovery time. Cancer cells had just begun to invade the surrounding tissue. No lymph nodes were involved. One of those doctors told me at the time that it would likely have been 2 more years before the lump would be detected manually. Right now, I could be in the midst of extensive treatment for breast cancer, which had spread far beyond the original lump. I'm fortunate to have insurance coverage that pays for annual exams, and I believe that this is an important coverage to maintain for all women. Early detection is very important, and I firmly believe that knowing that these procedures are covered makes it much more likely that women will see their providers on a regular basis. I hope you will agree with me and support this important law. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I'm a government relations specialist for Oregon School Employees Association and was proud to be the chief sponsor of the original legislation in 1993, which established the mandate for mammograms. I'm speaking to you today in support of Senate Bill 588 and to encourage you to pass Senate Bill 588 out of your committee today without amendments. I understand that there are amendments to this bill which would reestablish a sunset date on cervical exams and mammograms, and I think you have a nice long record that clearly indicates that women in Oregon's lives have been saved as a result of the legislation that was passed in 1993. I know that you will have the opportunity to feel as I do that something that you've done here today actually saves people's lives, and you can see that. As many of the things that you do are important, it's not very often that you can see that kind of direct result from your action. Senate Bill 588 is important to businesswomen, small businesswomen. Senate Bill 588's parent bill was really brought to the legislature as a result of small business women who came to us and said, look, I can only buy private insurance. I'm not covered by an HMO. I don't have a group health plan that I can be covered by. I'm the sole support of my children. I have my business to support. And one woman who was our inspiration was trying to support her children and her business while she fought breast cancer because her insurance company did not offer her mammograms, and her business was on a very close margin. And so she put her money into her family and into her business instead of into her health care, and as a result contracted breast cancer. I would hope that you would eliminate the need to come back to the legislature again and again and again to make the case for mammograms and cervical and pelvic exams, because there really is no question any longer as to the cost effectiveness and the rightness of requiring insurance companies to cover these important examinations.
Mr. Kennedy, what are your insights into the compromise that led to the sunset that caused you to tell us or suggest to us that we ought to reject it?
The compromise sunset is the compromise we had to make in 1993. It's the same compromise. And we made it because we didn't have, well, we wanted our bill passed, and also because there wasn't the experience level to show so clearly as you have it today that the connection between early detection and the saving of lives and the reduction in cost of treatment. And so while I thought it was important in 1993 in order to get our bill passed, I think there's less reason today than there ever was to include the sunset in the bill.
Thank you. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I agree. I mean, I think it is unfortunate that in order for us to move ahead on this bill, there was a compromise. There had to be a compromise reached on the sunset issue, but I don't think we need a sunset on this bill. We know it makes a difference and it's helping to save lives in our state. And I think it's ridiculous that women have to line up once again 6 years from now and come in and make the case for, you know, why we need to have this coverage. And I mean, you know, if that's what it's going to take to get this bill passed and to continue the coverage, then I'll support that. But it's very frustrating to me, and I thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Bruce?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm here representing Kaiser Permanente. You have copies of a written statement that we're submitting for your record, and I will just briefly highlight a couple of points from that testimony. Kaiser Permanente covered the services that are the subject of Senate Bill 588 before they were mandated in law in 1983, and Kaiser Permanente will continue to do so regardless of what decisions you make. These are important services whose general availability can lead to the early identification of breast and other cancers. We do not believe that the enactment of Senate Bill 588 will result in additional costs for Kaiser Permanente groups or enrollees. There may be a negligible additional administrative cost, however, because of the insurance division requirements that specific mandates in law be incorporated into the service agreements and contracts that we issue. And even though they are subtle changes in Senate Bill 588, those changes may require changes in those contracts to comply with the insurance division's requirements. As you have heard, there are two laws on the books that relate to mandated benefits generally. The first requires a study to accompany the bill of the social and financial impacts of mandated benefits. An example of how this kind of requirement can be satisfied occurred last week in the House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs in their consideration of House Bill 2581, a proposal that mandates maternity care benefits and that I believe did comply with those statutory requirements. I am not aware that the proponents of Senate Bill 588 have satisfied those requirements for this proposal. Second, as has been testified, ORS 743.700 provides for the repeal of health insurance mandates 6 years after their enactment. That law, too, has been on the books since 1985. With the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 588, those mandates will be subject to reconsideration before their repeal in 2005. Given the pace of changes in medical practice and technology, we believe that this is a reasonable requirement, and we support amending the bill for this end. In fact, I had understood until this morning, perhaps, that the Senate Minority Leader supported that provision. That position may have changed. Finally, I want to address a technical issue in the bill. The Dash 2 amendments propose to limit the requirements for diagnostic mammograms to, quote, symptomatic or high-risk women, unquote. This amendment appears to conflict with the requirement that's in the current law in subsection 2 that refers to a schedule. I believe that schedule is being deleted by the bill, and you may want to reconcile those provisions so that there's not conflict internally within the statute should you decide to enact it. Thank you very much.
Senator Shield?
Yes, quote your testimony, Bruce. And given the pace of change in medical practice and technology, why is the change in practice and technology relevant? I mean, we've got a sunset here. You don't need the sunset. I mean, what's the pace and changes in medical practice and technology? How's that going to impact a sunset?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, you are not only mandating the service be provided, you're mandating the schedule for those services and the availability to women at certain age, within certain age bands. So you're setting clinical practices as well as mandating service, and what is appropriate medical care may well change within the next 6 years. So rather than locking a requirement into law, you would have the flexibility within 6 years to change that. Obviously, you have flexibility to do that every 2 years, but in my experience, it's not the legislature's practice to do that, and this six-year periodic review gives you the opportunity to do that regularly.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
If technology advances and medical science advances so much, wouldn't it be more prudent for us just to bring a bill that says, hey, we've moved so far beyond this that we don't need it anymore, rather than to have an automatic sunset, which would require everybody to mobilize again in 6 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, that's certainly a policy option you could consider.
To me, it's a policy option. It makes more sense. I mean, you know, when, I mean, in all other arenas, when something becomes antiquated, then we go back to the law and we, I mean, we even have a committee around here that deletes laws that have become so out of date that they're considered ridiculous. I mean, we do that regularly. Why wouldn't we do it here? I'm just kind of wondering why the automatic sunset and what the compromise was and why it's required.
I might go back and don't remember exactly the term of Smith's service, but she might have some ideas in 1985 why this sunset mandate was proposed.
Mr. Chair, Tricia Smith, for the record, I was not in the legislature in 1985, so I don't know why that was put into the law in 1985. I do know why the sunset was attached to this bill, however, in 1993.
Mr. Chair, I want to just also say that, Bruce, you said something about that there hadn't been the requirement that the compliance about the requirements answering questions that deal with Oregon law when they're putting forth a mandate. And I believe that there has been a report and that the requirement has been fulfilled on this bill. Maybe you just haven't seen it, but it's my understanding that it was done on this bill. I don't know if Senator Fisher has it or not.
We don't have it.
Oh, okay.
It was.
In my office.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Senator Dunn.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you were later. They didn't do this. Playing to the crowd.
Well, just keep a little every time. My darn.
Oh, here I see. Okay, we have it, and I will introduce. I was wondering myself who brought it here.
Yeah.
Report on Women's Health Exams is the title of this. Interesting thing, the number one. Number one referral to evidence and materials for the Coors Brewing Company. It struck me as rather interesting. Apparently, the Coors Brewing Company has been, I mean, some cancer study. Mr. Bishop, did you get a chance to get a copy of this?
You still looking at it?
Yeah, the report. I'm entering into the record a testimony of Lynn Diane Parton, Women's Rights Coalition, in favor of Senate Bill 588. And a letter from the American Association of University Women from Allison Bartlett, the President, Kathy Eden, Public Policy Co-Chair, and Betty McChesney House Public Policy Committee, Oregon American Association of University Women, and favor of Senate Bill 588. I'm going to close the public hearing and go into a work session on Senate Bill 588.
I guess I'm not sure what the amendments. We need to do the minutes.
Yes, we need to do the
I move the dash. Two amendments to 588,
Mr. Chair. Senator Duncan has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 588. Objections? Further discussion?
Is this the sunset?
Yes.
So that's
what has to be. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One of my colleagues has said it very well in saying sometimes you don't know when to hold and when to fold. This is the point in the discussion of the bill where it becomes like a card game, I guess. I still don't understand what the insurance industry juggernaut is all about relative to needing these amendments, but I sure don't want to get in the way of the bill. If anybody would like to comment further on the necessity for the sunset, I'd be glad to hear that. Otherwise, in poker parlance, I'll fold and go along with everybody's wisdom. But if anybody would like to enlighten me some more, I'd sure appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Chair, the last person I want to take advice on whether to fold or something in a card game is to on poker is to listen to a Methodist minister. But,
now, let's not turn it into a theological debate. It's too early.
We're good to go with you anyway.
I'll get the Presbyterians to this. That are you too?
Senator Christine. Yeah, Mr. Chair. Oh.
Senator
Christine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's my understanding that Senator Brown is one of the lead sponsors, and Senator Bryant is also a co-sponsor on this, has reached an agreement with all the concerned parties, and that is why we have the bill before us today. We were all very, very concerned about this, making sure that this bill got through the process this session. So, you know, while I don't agree with all aspects of what had to be negotiated here, I definitely want to see this bill move, so I am willing to support those dash two amendments.
Senator Shin.
And I'm the one that told him you've got to know when to hold him. I just want to tell you that I think it's time to declare victory and vote yes and get it out of here and on over to the House.
Okay, and I carry no major objections and so ordered.
I move 588 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 588 with the dash two amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Yes. I want to say that I'm supporting this bill on behalf of women in America, but not on behalf of Planned Parenthood's testimony, because more Americans' lives are taken in Planned Parenthood clinics than all the wars, all the car accidents, all the heart attacks, and all the cancers annually, and everything else added together. So I'm doing this on behalf of the women and not their testimony.
I would just like to admit myself that I would like to see more cooperation between the groups ahead of time on these issues rather than always necessarily putting the legislature on the spot in a recognition that no matter how we look at it, we don't always, and we're not always able to capture in the same arena the money that have potential savings. And very often it's very difficult to work with these issues because the money that's saved over here doesn't necessarily transfer over there. And that's a problem that I've been trying to encourage government agencies to do more of, is to look at the finished product that we want and not necessarily look at each agency's budget and each division's budget right down the line as how it affects them individually in their agency. And I think we've got a lot of work to do, not just on the issues of what we're dealing with here today, but on the overall issue of how we treat those that have problems, because believe me, there isn't a medical procedure or a medical situation that doesn't cause tragedy somewhere in somebody's life, and a tragedy is a tragedy. And any way that we can work together to ameliorate some of these situations, it's far better to do it in the arena of the real world than it is to do it in the arena of a six-month high-pressure legislative session. So I would sure encourage the insurance companies, the people that provide insurance to their employees, those that are the insureds, that they would get together and continue to work and strive to understand each other's problems and to work every way we can to make these things better. And I thank everyone for coming today, and I'm going to ask the clerk to call the roll.
Senator Sammy?
Aye.
Senator Sammy?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Senator Brown, still here by chance? I'm going to take a chance that Senator Brown would like to carry the right bill and, or maybe make it mandatory. Close the work session on Senate Bill 588 and thank you for their work and help draft. Yes. Do we have any do we have any questions? Do we have to do that in work session? Okay. Senator Shannon would like to go carry his next question.
Okay.
We're going to open a public work session on Senate Bill 527.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 527 establishes a long-term care partnership program. We heard testimony from Senator Lynn Hammond and members of the industry on March 8th. We're bringing it back today with the Dash 1 Amendment. The Dash 1 Amendment clarifies which model Oregon would use should the opportunity arise if partnership plans be implemented in Oregon, and if the amendments identify the dollar-to-dollar model. You will remember that we had a dollar-to-dollar model versus a total asset model that was reviewed previously, and these amendments address that. And then it also modifies technical language. The original bill is based on other states' legislation, and the technical language modifies it to meet current Oregon statutes.
And who has been responsible for the Dash 1 Amendment?
Glenn Dayton, Peggy Annett.
Okay. And does Senator Hammond agree?
Yes.
On that? Is it passed since I don't see it in there? I think we're fine. Either Peggy and Glenn, or excuse me, or yeah, Peggy and Glenn. Jack, you just want to come and... And briefly, we're going to have to scoot here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett. I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. And we're here to support the Dash 1 amendments and thank Senator Shields for working with us on this as well. And we'd just be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, I didn't have any questions. I just wanted to make sure we had on the record then.
Yeah, and Glenn Dayton from Morgan Healthcare Association as well. Echo Peggy's comments that we're here in support of Senate Bill 527 and the Dash 1 amendments. And if there are any questions about those amendments or the bill itself, we're happy to answer them.
Okay. I want to take this opportunity to clarify potential conflict of interest in that I am a nursing homeowner operator and administrator and might in some way benefit from this bill if it provided insurance to those that avail themselves of my care. There are further sessions, objections, hearing none, I would take a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 527.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 527. Further ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve Senate Bill 527.
Okay. Okay, but it doesn't in this biennium. Okay, so we're not having to send it to fiscal or to release the means. Go ahead. Yes, Senator.
I move that we pass the Senate Bill 527 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steele moved that we send Senate Bill 527 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Will clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator
Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Chandler? Aye. Motion carries, and I believe probably Senator Hannon would like to carry this, and then he doesn't. Senator Shields has volunteered, so I believe we have a carrier for the bill. Open work session on Senate Bill 527 and open work session on Senate Bill 606.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 606 is modifying the definition of podiatry. We just received the amendment about an hour ago. I have one here that, and I did distribute them to the parties so that they have had hopefully an opportunity to review and touch base with each other on them.
Mm. Get three sets, are they all?
Right, they're different. The Dash 1 amendments were at the request of the orthopedic surgeon. These were just minor changes that they had requested. The Dash 2s were at the request of the Board of The Dash 1s were at the Board of Medical Examiners. The Dash 2s were at the request of the orthopedic surgeon. And the Dash 3s were also at the request of the orthopedic surgeon. I got a little confused, but I apologize.
Okay, so the ones are with the
Board of Medical Examiners.
Board of Medical Examiners.
And then the 2s and the 3s at the request of the orthopedic surgeon.
And the podiatrist on 606, or the orthopedic physician
on both. Orthopedic on both, Dash 2 and Dash 3.
Tom, you want to?
Chairman Tom Burrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. In discussions with the Board of Medical Examiners, an issue come up in talking to Dr. Hicks. The board met last week, and out of that, I believe, in the dash ones, and Kathleen Healy's here, and she can probably speak to that.
Okay.
We had a representative there, and Dr. Pearson will speak to that, but I believe we're okay with the dash ones. It makes some changes to clarify some concerns that the board had come up with.
How about the dash twos and threes?
I'll let Dr. Pearson speak to those.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. With regards to both
give your name.
I'm Dr. Gerald Peterson, current legislative chair for the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association, also past president. With respect to the dash twos and dash threes, I don't think either of these are necessary, in that the bill has already addressed both issues in the language and also the administrative rules, which were agreed upon by the BME and the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association last session, fully address these issues as well. So I don't see the, and they're basically administrative changes, administrative material that should be in administrative rules rather than in statute.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dash 3, you say it ought to be in rules, not statute?
Well, the basically the statute already addresses the training and the licensing issues regarding podiatric physicians and what requirements they have from an educational standpoint and training standpoint with respect to foot and ankle surgery.
Apologize, Mr. Chairman. We just got this a little bit ago. We had some handwritten late last week. Regarding the dash 3, my understanding is that changes or adjusts the definition of ankle in Section 2. The definition of ankle that we have here is what the Board of Medical Examiners gave to the work group that was created in the 96 interim to look at this issue. And so we didn't feel like we were in a position to make any changes to the definition. That was what was given to us and was part of the report that was issued by the Board of Medical Examiners. So from that standpoint, I think I think we have to go with what the board gave us. That's what our understanding from the work group and the charge of the bill 2 sessions ago was. The board was supposed to issue a report, and that was what was supposed to move forward.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I was referring to two rather than three, and I apologize.
Okay, will you go ahead and state that over again? I'm having a little trouble following here, trying to search through that.
Okay, I apologize. The dash threes, which I believe is what Senator Shields was asking about, adds to the definition of ankle in Section 2, as I read this. I may be... and then also adds where it says that surgery of the ankle must be conducted, and then sets administrative rules for the Board of Medical Examiners to write. It actually puts in statutes a piece of a surgeon who is certified by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery and Foot Reconstructive Vertebral and Ankle Surgery. And so that's a statute rather than in rule. Out of the report, I think the feeling was from two sessions or from two interims ago that the dust left the board. We had an understanding of what the board would write as rules, and that was included in there. But the feeling was that we dust and ruled in case there were changes in the board, things like that, rather than putting in statute.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Shields.
So specifically, lines 7 to 9 are best in the rule.
That was our understanding.
Yeah,
that was understanding. Agreement out of the work group and in the letter that the board wrote to the legislature.
And those were also agreed upon by the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association as well.
What about the definition of lifelong surgery?
Mr. Chairman, the definition of ankle in Section 2 was spelled out in the report that was issued by the Board of Medical Examiners, so we took that ankle definition and plugged it in here. And so I think that's sort of my feeling was that's what we had to go with, was what the board had issued as the report, as the definition of ankle. So adjusting that, I'm not sure, maybe Dr. Pearson can talk to the specifics of that, because I don't, the anatomy is a little beyond my scope.
Mr. Chairman, I think, and members of the committee, I think the intent in changing the language and inserting this 5 millimeters is somehow an attempt to try and draw some kind of imaginary line.
I think that's, again, the process by which we're concerned and have this whole issue before you. There is no way to draw a line. The idea is that you want to define specifically and clearly what a podiatric physician is trained to do. And if you try to draw some imaginary line somewhere, you get into this issue, and it's very difficult to put this line where it stops, where it ends, where the foot stops, where the foot ends, what the ankle is, etc. And I alluded to in my previous testimony before this committee, I spent 2 years debating this issue on a national level, trying to determine a scope of practice, and worked with one of the country's well-known orthopedic surgeons who debated this issue with us. And we came to a very similar definition of the foot and ankle in the scope of practice for our national association, which mirrors this very closely. We've been a little bit more specific than our national scope was in an attempt to meet the requirements for our state and get this bill completed. However, the intent, I think, of this, again, is to try to place some kind of a line. The definition of the ankle, I think, was very well done by the Board of Medical Examiners. We accepted their report. We're willing to work with that definition with the understanding that the procedures, if you will, that are done on the foot and ankle, which are very clearly defined in any surgical text, that are necessary to perform those procedures on the ankle, are what's going to be within the scope of practice of the podiatric surgeon. When you talk about leg fractures are leg fractures. They're also very clearly defined. And it's not the intent of the podiatric physician to go up the leg and do any kind of leg surgery. We just want to be able to do what we're trained and clarified and to clarify, should we say, the scope of practice of what we're trained and well-trained to do. And I think this definition really doesn't change that and just complicates the issue.
Yeah, of course. I've read all the literature, and I have, and I probably should know that. Are all podiatrists in Oregon trained in the ankle?
Yes, ma'am.
All? Every practicing podiatrist?
Yes, ma'am.
Right now?
Yes, ma'am.
For a year?
Pardon me? No, we have 4 years. We have 4 years of podiatric medical education, and our residencies vary right now anywhere from 1 to 4 years.
How much on the ankle?
How much of the ankle? It's all on the foot and ankle. That's all we do. So the entire program is dedicated, whether it's 1, 2, 3, or 4 years on the foot and ankle. Much like an ENT residency would be on ear, nose, and throat, you know, your gynecological training on your residency for ear, nose, and throat.
You got this right?
If you were an ear, nose, and throat specialist, you wouldn't be doing your residency program on gynecological examinations or orthopedics or whatever. You'd be limited to ear, nose, and throat. Obviously, that's your specialty. That's what you want to train in. So the extended training programs in the residency are dedicated to those areas.
Well, I know someone said that the ear, nose, and throat specialists are close to the brain, but they don't work on the brain.
That's correct. That's why we don't work on the leg either.
Every doctor, every podiatrist has been trained on ankle surgery.
On ankle surgery, yes. They understand the procedures, but not every podiatric physician has extended training. As far as our residency program is concerned, you don't do a 1, 2, or 3, or 4 year program. Right now, our programs are expanding to include even more well-defined training. So many programs, for example, the first year programs are now going, many programs are going to 2 and 3 year programs that were previously 1 year programs. And now they have, the first year has been dedicated basically to all 4 foot surgery. The second year program, for example, is more ankle, rear foot, and reconstructive surgery, trauma surgery, et cetera. So they're expanding it, if you will, the training and more defining it so that, again, training continues to evolve, as any other specialty would.
I heard that answer just a little tiny bit different than when I asked it a while ago. But every doctor that is a podiatrist, in Oregon has had surgery training on the ankle and operated. If they put the shingle up, I can now operate on your ankle. They have been trained, and they have, everyone now that has that podiatrist degree has operated on ankles, and therefore if this bill passes, they all could continue to operate on ankles because they've been trained in operating on ankles.
Okay, let me clarify, Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon. As far as your training is concerned, yes, we have been trained to perform the procedures as far as our training is concerned, as far as the actual surgical experience that comes in the residency program. while we have the book knowledge, just like any other physician has the book knowledge at the end of their four-year training program, that doesn't mean that they're qualified to do these specifics of the procedure. You go on to your residency training and acquire those skills. And that's where the training as far as the osseous ankle surgery and soft tissue ankle surgery comes into place. That's where the osseous foot surgery and soft tissue surgery comes into place, is during the residency program. Not every podiatric physician in the state of Oregon has those extended training programs. That's one of the reasons why we put the suggestions in the administrative rules, that if we're going to have ankle surgeons qualified and licensed to perform those procedures, that they meet the requirements that we have set forth and the board has agreed to in the extended training programs for the podiatric surgeons doing ankle surgery.
Okay.
That is the two-year residency program and the board certification in foot surgery. We have a licensing board for, we actually have two licensing boards in our profession. One is in podiatric orthopedics and primary care, which is kind of like the family practice, if you will, of podiatric medicine. And we have a surgical certifying board that certifies our surgeons to perform podiatric surgery.
So every podiatrist can't put up the shingle that he's now an ankle surgeon unless they have gone through two-year residency of operating on ankles.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, that's correct.
Sheriff, I think Dr. Peterson misunderstood your first question as all having just training in ankle,
okay,
and all podiatrists do have training in ankle. However, under this and with the administrative rules that we've agreed to, very few podiatrists would be allowed to do the extensive ankle surgery.
Only the ones. Okay.
Yes, right, and so I just want to make sure that was clear.
Okay. I may have got lost in the translation.
Well, I just want to know if you have the experience of operating on ankles.
Only those that the board would be allowed to.
Thank you.
I'm going to invite testimony from Mike Kessley and Jonathan Popper.
Mr. Chair, let me ask you a question. Are we going to, and maybe I slipped up for a second. I need to hear where the Board of Medicare is.
They're here? We'll also.
Oh, okay, good. Okay. Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah, you got it. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Association of Orthopedists. And with me today are Mike Bessely, an orthopedic surgeon from Portland, and Dr. Jonathan Hobart, an orthopedic surgeon who practices in Oregon City. And we know you, it is getting late and you've already heard testimony from us, but we would like to explain why we propose the amendments, although I want to emphasize we still oppose the bill. Do you want to address the amendments?
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Mike Fessler. I'm an orthopedic surgeon in Portland, Oregon. I work for Kaiser Permanente. I submitted my testimony to you in writing, so I will make that very brief and then address some of the amendment components. My training consisted of 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 6 years of surgical, general, and orthopedic training, and 1 year of post-residency surgery training. I've worked with podiatrists both in private practice at Good Samaritan Hospital, mostly podiatric residents. Also, there are podiatrists that are members of my current department at Kaiser Permanente. I think all podiatrists are a valuable member of our team. I think for what they're qualified to do now, they provide an aid to myself. I strongly do not think they're qualified to operate on the ankle. It is not uncommon that I'm called to the operating room to help out our podiatrists who need some help in finishing a case where things have gotten a little out of hand. I've had experience with podiatric residents assisting me on ankle fracture cases where they hold retractors. I do the case. They mark the case down as an ankle case that they have done. I think before you consider voting for this bill, you need to think about protection of the public. The public in general does not know that podiatrists are not medical doctors. Feel that they are. They're going to trust you as seeing whether or not these providers are qualified for this expanded scope of practice. The ankle does not exist in a vacuum. I actually agree with Dr. Peterson. There is no imaginary line. I'm the one that proposed the definition of plafond because plafond is in their definition of ankle, and you need to define plafond. In my testimony to you all, I have Xeroxed the definition of plafond, which is French for ceiling. Actually, it's an elaborate ceiling. It's formed by the floor, so it's a ceiling formed by the roof above. And that is the definition of plafond, which is in the bill and is not defined. If you look in textbooks on trauma, the ankle chapters will frequently start by saying the ankle does not exist in the vacuum, that you must consider both the foot and the leg in treating ankle problems. My concern is if you treat ankle fractures, you need to be able to treat the tibia as well as the knee. You need to all consider that this bill will expand the scope of practice to allow podiatrists to operate on ankle fractures. And I don't understand semantics here between training and experience. To me, training means you've actually done the case. It doesn't mean you read about it in a book. It doesn't mean someone told you how to do it. It means you've actually done it. If you look at the American Board of Podiatric Surgeons, which I called last week, and you look at who they have certified for complex ankle and reconstructive rear foot surgery, it is 120 podiatrists in the entire country. It is less than 1% of the podiatrists in this country. I strongly urge you to consider the amendments as proposed. Lafond was not attempting to redefine the ankle. It was attempting to define a term that is in the bill. I strongly urge you to oppose this bill if you can see fit, and I thank you for your time.
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Shannon.
How many did you say that they have certified in the country?
Chairman Fisher, Senator Shannon, according to the American Board of Podiatric Surgery, those surgeons after 1992, which is a grandfathered year, in other words, before 92 you were grandfathered, after 92 you had domestic criteria, and had certification in complex rear foot ankle reconstructive surgery, 120 in the United States.
Don't you think that's prudent of them?
I think that's very prudent. That is less than 1% of all podiatrists in the United States. And to be honest with you, I think those people are probably qualified to operate on the ankle. What I'm asking you here today is to consider the public is not asking for this. The public is counting on you, in part, to protect them. And that is it worth subjecting the public to unnecessary risk of less than 1% of these providers?
One follow-up. If they've been that prudent in the nation, what makes you think they won't be that prudent with all these guidelines, you know?
They don't exist in the bill right now. I'm sorry, Senator Shannon.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. They don't exist in the bill right now.
Those safeguards?
They're not in there right now, and there's no clear measure that the BME is under any mandate to accept those as the criteria.
Dr. Duffin.
Yes, sir.
Who controls the BME?
I do not know that question. I should know that question. My uncle just retired from the BME, and I do not know the answer.
My understanding is their board is doctors.
They are all doctors, sir. There are no surgeons on the BME as it exists. There is an anesthesiologist, an ear, nose, and throat, who is a surgeon on the ear, nose, and throat, a gynecologist. There are no orthopedic or general surgeons on the BME currently.
But they certainly are in a position to understand medical practice.
Absolutely, sir.
And that's what I'm saying. And it says here very plainly that they will be the ones that are giving the established rule. And to my knowledge, no podiatrist even sits on the Board of Medical Examiners. But they also control the podiatrists. Is that true?
There is a Podiatry Advisory Council. My understanding is the BME listens to the Podiatry Advisory Council. There is no podiatrist that sits on the Board of Medical Examiners, sir.
So the medical doctors control the board. The board sets the rule and regulation for which they practice. They cannot practice anywhere but in a hospital certified in the manner described by ORS now. My understanding, podiatrists don't sit on the board. They do very seldom, and certainly not the majority. So again, you have doctors controlling this. And I'm quite certain that a good many orthopedists are set on hospital boards or in an ambulatory surgical center certified by the health division, again, which is controlled by doctors. I find that from my own thinking, and I'm not one to go hastily on this, but technology changes. Doctors have come from basically barbers in the last 150 years. And when I said that once, one of the doctors said he was glad that he wasn't a barber now. But it's almost impossible to say that you're not going to have scope of practice issues as long as education changes, as as long as technology changes. I don't know of anything, basically, that gets easier to attend. I've seen an extreme metamorphosis take place in the nursing home administration over 31 years. Going to anybody basically over 18 years of age that wanted to put in so much time and take a test to now required college education and some related course, a four-year degree, then 6 months of a regimented course, over 21. It's just manifold more things that are written tests, verbal tests, manifold things that they have to do now in comparison to what was required before. And that beggars my thinking that when this knowledge does and people do these things, that even if there's only 120 of them out there, which would maybe have two or two and a half of them to Oregon, those people still ought to have an opportunity to operate within their scope of practice. And I know it's an interesting article in Saturday's Statesman Journal. Wrong hip replaced at D.C. Hospital. Guess what? An orthopedic physician did a real good job on somebody's wrong hip. This is a problem that bothers me because we have rogues, we have problems in every profession. And to just write off a profession from doing something that they want to do because they're supposedly not trained when the very people that are talking about this have the control over them, to me, causes me a real problem into how to know. I don't think I'm turning a whole bunch of people loose on an unsuspecting public. Complained that this was going to allow them to do all kinds of casting on and other non-surgical procedures on the ankle. It's every bit of testimony that they're doing that right now. And I haven't been flooded with people coming in here and saying, oh my, a podiatrist really messed me up. But you can see the quandary that we're in by trying to allow somebody that's registered and has to pay the state a fee to get licensed and certified and registered and regulated and all this kind of thing, and then maybe possibly denying them an opportunity to work for them the framework in which they're trained and experienced.
That's your question. You made a statement earlier that many times, not many, often in surgery, but the doctors have been doing surgery and you've been called in to kind of straighten things out. What kind of surgery were they doing? Is that just foot surgery or were they dealing with it? They weren't dealing with the ankle at that point, were they?
One was a case of a complex talus fracture. A talus is a bone that articulates with the ankle and is within the podiatrist's scope of practice right now. Fracture was complex. They were having trouble. Could not fix it properly. Another was the case of a gentleman that was going to undergo a 4-foot amputation. It was an abscess. The abscess tracked up above the ankle. This had not been known prior to surgery. It should have been known prior to surgery, in my opinion. These are both cases that have happened to me in the last 12 months.
But you were called.
I was called, but I guess my point is here. When this podiatrist is in trouble, they're not calling another podiatrist to bail them out. They're calling orthopedists to bail them out. May I respond to the wrong hip? There is no defense for that. I see every patient that I'm going to operate on 1 or 2 days prior, and I ask them to write no on the extremity I'm not operating on. There's no excuse, there's no defense for operating on the wrong side. That doesn't go to scope of practice or training. That goes to paying attention and doing your job well. And I strongly feel that this is not denying the majority of providers who are qualified to do something the ability to make a living. I strongly feel this is something they're not qualified to do.
Dr. Huff.
Senator Fisher and members of the committee, for the sake of time and brevity, I know your time is running short. I'm not going to reiterate what Dr. Vesely has told you. My primary concern and driving principle here is public safety. And this has to do with training and certification As you gathered from the previous testimony, there is confusion in regard to training and certification. It pervades podiatric care and podiatric training. There is no uniform monitoring through medical school or the surgical training that is provided to podiatrists. There is no annual in-training examination, for example, that the podiatrist receiving surgical training have to take. Therefore, there is no assessment of progress in education. There's no assessment of the various programs that provide this surgical training. Adding to this confusion is the variety of boards that have been described. There is the American Board of Podiatric Surgery, the American Board of Podiatric Orthopedics, and Primary Podiatric Medicine. These are the two that you hear the most about, but there's also the American Council of Certified Podiatric Physicians and Surgeons, a board which has recently taken antitrust litigation against the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. I believe that this litigation is still is still pending. Additionally, there's another board, the American Podiatric Medical Specialties Board. Now, this is the only board that has been accredited by the government's accrediting agency, the National Commission of Certifying Agencies. Now, accordingly, the American Podiatric Medical Association has recently proposed a resolution for recognition of this board by the other certifying boards, so they can therefore gain this accreditation. Dr. Vesely told you what the training was for an orthopedic surgeon. The entire training, the 4 years of postgraduate education that a doctor undergoes, is monitored in a uniform fashion by one regulatory commission, and that's the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery. Only with the annual in-training examination that the doctors take to assess their progress in education and assess the quality of the program, how does one get through this? 2 years after completion of that program, then an orthopedic surgeon is eligible for certification. Mr. Chairman, until podiatric training demonstrates a standard quality and a unified board certification process, the passage of Senate Bill 606 may serve to expose unsuspecting Oregon public to incompetent treatment of ankle disorders.
Thank you for your testimony. We've got a call of the Senate, and I'm going to quote the board section on Senate Bill 606 and direct the staff to have it ready on a work session on Wednesday. Both the Senate section on Health and Human Services Committee.